Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, David Simon. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hey, Dave, could you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got interested in veganism?
Sure. I actually saw a movie on HBO about 12, maybe 13 years ago called I Am an Animal, which is about Ingrid Newkirk, who founded PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The show is a documentary that looked at her life and why she's chosen the lifestyle that she's chosen. And at the time, veganism wasn't on my radar at all, but I was curious about why somebody would take such a drastic approach to changing her lifestyle over animal concerns. And it led me to look into some of the issues. And once I did, I decided that I had to go vegan.
David, the El Paso Vegan Book Club group met last week and discussed your book, Meatonomics. And several people in the group were astonished by how much money is used to support the meat and dairy industry, how much of our tax dollars. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book and how long it took?
Sure. So the book probably took me 4 years to research and write. And I actually started out writing a slightly different book and actually for a different publisher. And as I was writing that first book, which was more sort of about the general issues related to animal protection and some of the legal concerns, I became aware of these sort of major economic issues, mostly with externalized costs, which is an economic term to describe how some industries impose their cost of production on society, on consumers and taxpayers. And as I sort of saw how big these numbers were, I changed the book that I was writing, and the result was Meatonomics.
And so when you talk about the major economic issues, and maybe we should step back too and talk about externalities. I think I've heard you describe it once before as if someone's externalizing their costs, you know, if it's you not picking up, if you don't want to pay for someone to come pick up your trash and in essence internalize the cost, you would just go and say you go and dump it in the park, and then you're externalizing the cost of that pickup on the rest of society. What kind of, in terms of the meat production and animal products, what exactly is getting externalized upon us as consumers and citizens of this country?
So when I looked at these numbers several years ago in the course of writing this book, I came up with several categories for externalized costs. These are the costs that the animal production industry imposes on society. The biggest of these is healthcare. Those costs work out to about $314 billion a year. We've also got environmental damage, works out to about $37 billion a year. Subsidies, about $38 billion a year. And then some other categories that come out to about $25 billion together. And all told, it's over $400 billion.
That's a lot.
It's a big number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you go about assigning a cost to an externality, because it seems like there's a little bit of wiggle room in there?
Well, for example, let's take the environmental number, which is around $37 billion. There are lots of published peer-reviewed studies that talk about particular forms of environmental harm that are caused by the animal agriculture industry in this country. For example, soil erosion, which makes soil less productive. Pollution of rivers, lakes, and streams, which means that we can't use those bodies of water for recreation or for drinking. Those studies have added up the cost to our country on an annual basis of animal agriculture, literally as it relates to those particular environmental harms. And because we know the portion of the overall agriculture load in this country that's related to animals as opposed to crops, we can simply parse those numbers out and figure out, okay, if they say that the total burden is this much, then the part that's related to animals is this much.
It seems,
so I sort of went through those computations for each category.
It seems to me that pollution, soil erosion are one factor of the equation, but if you count in climate change, which is caused in large part by animal agriculture, then the damage caused by floods and wildfires could kick that figure up even higher.
Yeah, actually, the portion of the environmental figure that is related to climate change is about $9 billion each year. So that's just the portion of harm resulting from climate change each year that is caused by animal agriculture in this country.
That's
about
incredible.
$9 billion.
When you're talking about the assignment of the costs to animal agriculture versus crops, when that is parsed out, do they include the crops that are grown to feed the animals? Because I know that in the U.S., a large number of the crops that are actually grown for animal feed, not for direct human consumption.
Right. So in doing the math on something, let's say, for example, on subsidies, we as taxpayers spend something like $38 billion each year to subsidize the animal agriculture industry in this country. That figure includes subsidies to a large portion of feed crops like corn and soy, because we know that those crops are used, the majority of those crops are used to feed animals. So yes, that subsidy figure, for example, does include feed crops that are related to animals.
I think we should just also make a big note of that. How many billion of dollars are we talking about again in total?
414.
Yeah, and that's just in the U.S. alone. That's not counting any other country in the world that is engaged in animal agriculture.
That's right. The number is likely over $1 trillion worldwide.
Wow. And maybe we should take a step back, too. And how in this country do we get to the point where we're allowing this to happen, that we're able to keep this industry afloat and support it through our tax dollars and through subsidies and things of that nature? How do we even get to this point?
Well, that's a complicated question that involves cultural traditions, institutional biases, et cetera. The factory farming industry didn't really hit its stride in this country until the middle of the last century. So in 1920, for example, a lot of these issues hadn't even started to evolve yet. Animal agriculture wasn't harming our economy the way it would in a few decades. What's happened is that as factory farming has become the, not just the predominant, but almost the exclusive way by which we raise animals for consumption in this country, the economics have changed in ways that have made the participants very powerful, given them a very strong leg hold in state and state legislatures and in the federal Congress, made them entrenched.
You know, the segment of your book, Meatonomics, that deals with the idea of taxing meat made a lot of sense. And it seemed like it was a very rational, reasonable approach, which would never be accepted by the Congress of the United States because of the power behind the lobbyists.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yes, taxes are very unpopular. But look at what happened with tobacco. In the 1950s, clinically, we thought that tobacco was somewhere between good for us and not bad for us. And over the course of a number of decades, as that clinical position changed, as the medical community started to recognize that tobacco is actually killing Americans, policymakers took note. And so we started to actually tax tobacco at the state and federal level. And eventually, 20 years ago or so, Congress actually funded major transition programs that allowed tobacco farmers to get out of that business and to do other things like raise wine grapes. So I think that what's likely to happen with animal foods is that as the medical science catches up, as the medical community eventually becomes aware that this is a product not unlike tobacco that is killing Americans, eventually policymakers will get on board and eventually they'll take steps to change the way we consume these products in this country. And taxation is one of those steps I think we'll see.
You know, I think a lot of meat companies have recognized this coming change, and with groups like Tyson and Cargill supporting meat alternatives, they must have the knowledge that things are going to change.
I think that's right. You see that happening on an ongoing basis. In fact, just this morning, I read in the newspaper that a small plant-based meat startup called Before the Butcher has just been acquired by a meat producer. And we're going to see a lot of this. It's an industry that's got a lot of growth.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to hopefully the hope for the movement is it may actually come through business and not through laws, which in our country are for the most part designed to protect this industry and make as easy for them to continue doing business as is, you know, with these standard exemptions for factory farm practices, for the way they treat animals on farms, to ag-gag laws, to a variety of different legal mechanisms in which our country is trying to make it easy for these animal agriculture to profit and at the same time pollute our planet and poison people and hurt their health. Perhaps that is the hope, is the business model or the business change.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a complicated interplay between the way that businesses function and the way that consumers respond to marketing, the way that medical science and clinical publications inform us about what's good and bad for us, the way that societal attitudes change. And again, I look at tobacco as the analogy here. In 1950, roughly one in two adults in this country smoked. People smoked at work. I mean, that was a thing. You smoked on airplanes. You smoked wherever you went. It was culturally accepted to do that. And as the medical science educated us, that became culturally unacceptable. You can't smoke at work now. You can't smoke in public places in most states.
It makes me think that I wasted a lot of time protesting when I should have been out increasing demand by buying more veggie burgers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. In the community where I live, one of the groups that I'm involved with is actually has a campaign where we're calling restaurants to get them to add vegan options. And maybe that's a thing. Maybe just making it more available to more people and available more easily is going to help change attitudes.
I tried to use that strategy recently when I went to Starbucks. You know how they always ask you, do you want anything other than your drink? And I always say no, because you have no vegan options. And then the teller said, well, actually, our whatever bagel is vegan. So I ended up having to buy that bagel even when I didn't really want one, just because since it was there, I had to do it. But here in El Paso, in our Veg Society, we took another approach recently where we had a Training the Chefs event where we invited local chefs from hospitals, schools, and restaurants to have a training with a Humane Society of the U.S. executive chef. And we've seen some real positive outcomes from that, and that was a real fun event too.
Yeah, so, like one chain of hospitals added vegan food to their cafeteria menu.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, there seemed to be a great interest in it. I think it was just that first starting point. They'd heard about it. They'd started to read about the benefits of a plant-based diet, but really didn't know quite where to start yet. So I think that was a nice point for them to jump from.
Sometimes people just need a tiny nudge.
Yeah.
That helps them move along.
Yeah. And then I think also people are reading more and more about all these food recalls with meat. And,
yeah,
you know, that also I think is a concern to people as well. Like almost every day or week in the news, there's some giant food recall of meat products because of either contamination with coliforms or like metal scraps, you know, because of the fast production line and the way that animals are being handled nowadays. It's just incredibly sad.
Right.
Yeah. And also the prevalence of diabetes and heart disease in our community and nationally. And that speaks to your research on externalities of the healthcare costs, over $300 billion a year. It's amazing that we have in this country, essentially, the government is promoting, right? I mean, through the USDA is promoting foods that are actually making people sick.
Yeah, that's really one of the disturbing things about the way the USDA works. It's got these two conflicting objectives. One is to educate consumers about what they should be eating and how they should be gaining the daily nutrients they need. And the other completely conflicting objective is to promote the animal agriculture industry. And these, as we see over and over, these objectives are often in conflict.
Well, or like just recently, I saw they're trying to get milk fat back into school lunch programs. I was like, oh, brother, with the obesity problems that we have with childhood obesity, and it's all we need is more fat in the poor kids' diets.
Yeah, and how easy would it be to switch to coconut milk or soy milk or rice milk or whatever instead of that as part of it everyday meals for, you know, millions of kids?
But that's highly subsidized as well, right, the school lunch program?
It is. Dairy is subsidized. School lunches are subsidized. There are messaging programs that the federal government's involved in that put posters promoting dairy in schools. Celebrities with milk mustaches that are encouraging kids to drink more milk. Lots of different ways that our both federal and state governments are trying to get us to consume more dairy and eat more meat.
What do you think that would be most helpful for people to do to help turn the tide and to get more people to realize these economic costs and what we're actually doing to ourselves and our planet? What approach are you taking now?
Well, the easiest thing for someone to do, if they're not already doing this, is to change their diet to a plant-based diet. If they're currently eating a lot of meat, they could just cut that back. They could change the way that they get their protein, calcium, and iron to move to plant-based sources. If people are already plant-based or vegan, then I've found that everybody's got sort of different levels of interest and different talents. Some people are good at writing letters. Some people are good at making movies. Some people are good at standing on a corner with a sign. Some people can make phone calls. You know, as I mentioned, we're calling restaurants near us to get them to add vegan options. Another campaign we did last year, sort of like your Educating the Chef program that you did, was we had a local vegan chef challenge where we challenge a lot of restaurants to add a vegan item or multiple items to their menus for a month. And then we encourage people to go try those items, and that's quite successful. You know, we've got things as radical as people who stand around holding videos showing what happens in factory farms. In fact, I'll be participating in one of those on Saturday. We call it a cube of truth. Sometimes those are quite impactful. There are a lot of different steps in between. People could call their state or local representatives and say, hey, this whole thing with the subsidies is ridiculous. What can you do to change that?
Right. I think one of the things that your book does very well, and you do very well in Meatonomics, is sort of breaking down these giant costs and these numbers in a way that makes sense. And I think a good way to do that, because we hear billions of dollars and sometimes it can get lost, I think. But maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, how much does a $5 Big Mac cost, you know, in total when we think about all these other factors?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I like that particular example. If you think of a Big Mac that costs on a retail basis $5 when somebody goes into the McDonald's restaurant to buy it, you were to add on top of that all of the externalized costs related to that Big Mac, that works out to an additional $8 or so. So that Big Mac would actually cost $13. Or we can say that its full societal cost is more like $13, not $5. And if animal-based foods like Big Macs were allowed to rise to their full societal cost, in other words, if when people went into McDonald's, they had to pay $13 for a Big Mac, what we would see is that consumption of these items would fall dramatically, at least by over 50%, if not more.
Right. I definitely do like that, because I feel like you can, when you think about on every choice that you make, every meal that you prepare, you know, has these costs with it, and it certainly adds up, and it's not something that's negligible by any means.
No, it's a real number. And by the way, if you don't eat Big Macs or you don't eat meat or dairy of any kind, you are nevertheless contributing to that societal cost. Each of us who pay taxes in this country is helping to prop up that industry.
And our health care insurance costs are much greater than they would be if we didn't have all the medical problems we have because of meat and dairy.
That's right. All of us who don't eat meat are subsidizing those higher premiums as well.
Yeah, it's just incredible when you think of the whole picture overall, how this industry has been so successful of hiding all of these facts from people for so many years and having people think that they have to have beef for dinner or that you have to have, you know, the classic question asked to vegans, where do you get your protein? Everybody thinks that you need so much protein, you know, just because of all this marketing.
And your bones will fall apart if you don't drink milk.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's
right.
It's part of the checkoff program, right, David? That's allowing this type of advertising to go on?
Yes. So for people who aren't aware of how the checkoff programs work, these are congressionally adopted and mandated programs that collect funds that are used to market meat and dairy to American consumers. And they're responsible for messages that we see and have seen all the time in all sorts of media that say things like beef, it's what's for dinner, pork, be inspired, milk, life, milk does a body good. There's lots of them. And Congress allows private organizations, like, for example, the Texas Cattlemen's Beef Association, to collect these funds on the sale of, on the wholesale transactions involving animals, and then to use the funds to promote their goods. And they're incredibly effective. The checkoff programs themselves release data that shows that for every dollar they spend promoting these foods, on average, there's about an 8-to-1 return on investment, which is just huge.
Where can people go to learn more about your work and all of these issues that you're talking about?
Well, again, my book is Meatonomics. It's available on Amazon. My website is meatonomics.com. There are lots of great resources available. If you just Google an issue like factory farming or animal agriculture, you'll find lots of short, sort of pithy videos on these topics. I think those are often a great way to get started and learning more about these issues as well.
We've been talking with David Simon, author of the book Meatonomics. Thank you for being with us on the program, David.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's been great.
It was great. Thanks, David.